Anyway, I was speaking at a Lutheran church in Bowling Green, and family sitting over to my left, two teenage boys and a mother, and I could tell that they were brothers. One had a problem. The one who had the problem, it was cerebral palsy, I found out later. But the lady came up afterwards and told me a bit of their story. She was pregnant. She was 20-odd weeks, if I remember, maybe 26, 28 weeks, something like that. And the doctors could determine that there's a baby. One of the babies had a trouble, but they couldn't figure out which one. So they came back to her with a recommendation that she abort the smaller one. And she said no. And the babies were far enough along that if they spontaneously delivered, they had a good chance of saving them. And the one they could determine was larger, and just by assumption, they thought, well, this one will do fine, even if they spontaneously deliver. And so it turns out that she carries the babies to term. And when they were born, the larger baby, the one that they thought would be the healthy baby, turned out to be the baby that had the problem. So if she had followed the recommendations of the doctor and aborted the smaller baby, she would have aborted the healthy baby. Now that's not the end of the story, because now they have a baby that has physical problems, and they go to the insurance company to get coverage, and the insurance company would not pay because they had not followed the recommended procedure. Now this happens again and again. So all of a sudden you've got insurance, you've got legal things. Now on the other hand, if the doctor hadn't picked this up and the babies and the woman would have aborted, then she would have had a lawsuit if she could go then and say she would have aborted. And what these folks did, they were Christians, they accepted that this was what God had given them. They found two other families that would join them in a class action suit, because there were other instances of the insurance company not paying, but they decided not to do that for their own reasons. They had enough to handle to deal with you know, the baby, the disabled baby. So these are all sorts of ramifications that come, and it's really, on some of these things, it's hard to know. And when you start reading, and like I said, I'm a generalist, but occasionally I'll find a technical article, say on PGD or something like this, and you find that some of these things are not 100% accurate. In fact, they're not even close to 100%. So what we may be doing is we're doing selective reduction, or if we're screening embryos, we may be missing some that we think we're catching, or catching some that we think we're missing. You know, we're making mistakes there, because we're depending on the science to be more precise than it really is. So anyway, I wanted to mention that story and to just give you an idea that insurance as well, and then in talking about your pharmacy school, the rights of conscience, the pharmacist, is he obligated to fill a prescription for the morning after pill, those kind of things. Back to the question on the human condition according to Peter Singer. I think your point of it, according to Peter Singer, we're animals, there's nothing exceptional about us. The humanism from the Enlightenment was really a leftover, a probably secularized version of Christianity, sort of a Christian memory. Humans are above the animals. There's hardly anyone now defending human exceptionalism. Are any of you familiar with Wesley Smith? He does some great things in the area of bioethics. You're familiar with Wesley Smith. He tries to defend human exceptionalism, and he bases it on the old humanism. Wesley is just a little bit older than me, so it's probably a generational thing. He was a humanist. I don't know if he's a Christian. Supposedly he is some sort of a Christian now. But I think some of his baggage there, he doesn't realize how far the culture has moved. Now, in one way he does, for sure. But the weight of his humanism, saying that humans are exceptional, and how to defend that in this culture is very, very difficult. But as Christians, of course, we go back to Genesis, to the creation, to the special status that was given, to be stewards of the earth, to care for the earth, to not only care for the earth, but to reproduce, to fill the earth. So we have a task of stewardship. And I think it's in the image of God where we ultimately ground our defense of our view of human nature. And there may be some natural law defenses that we can make. We may be able to find wedge points where people are not consistent with their preference utilitarianism or their commitment to personhood. So like a person like Peter Singer, you know, it's different when it's your mom. You know, if you had access to Peter Singer and you could talk with him and build a relationship and over time, there may be something that you could work on there. You know, what is it in you that made that exception? Is it just your preference? Or is there something behind that and maybe try to tease that out and work on it? But the Christian worldview is radically, radically different than the worldview of Peter Singer. He's not only an atheist, he's a Darwinian of sorts, he's some sort of a neo-Marxist as well in his politics. Peter Singer is... there are a number of things that I could say about Peter Singer, but more importantly than anything is that if you read the chapter from this book, any of you get to read that, the chapter in place of the old ethic. The reason I suggested that for the students is that really what you find in Peter Singer, he is a revolutionary. He's a man of ideas. He writes well and clear. And his agenda is to upset the Judeo-Christian tradition that remains and the sanctity of life ethic that grows out of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And in fact, as he starts out the essay, he talks about the Judeo-Christian view of man being at the pinnacle. And he just dismisses that. He just sets it aside. He doesn't engage the theology of it. In fact, he just says on the second page of that essay, he says, "The Copernican theory nevertheless triumphed." He's drawing a parallel between the triumph of the Copernican theory and the new ethic that he's advocating. He says, and he's drawing the parallel, not because it was more accurate than the old one, but because it was a fresh approach full of promise. And that's the way he advocates his viewpoint, is that it's a new approach. It is adequate to the world that we live in, whereas Christianity and Judaism, that view of man is old, it's passé. But Peter Singer is a revolutionary, and the people. Yes, absolutely, yeah, and he's very influential and very clear about what he wants to do. Now there are segments of secular bioethics that will not accept Peter Singer because of the bestiality and things like that. But he is, in many ways, typical of mainline bioethics, secular bioethics. So we not only have secularism, but within that secular framework, we have different worldviews, transhumanism, the post-humanists, a number of folks like that, who advocate against a Christian worldview. So whatever defense that we make, it has to be based on our worldview, and then looking beyond our worldview, to some sort of a natural law sort of defense where we can engage those folks, we engage them there, and then lead them and bring them to a Christian view of what it means to be human. Yes, sir?
Just a quick clarification question. People talk about transhumanism. Is that like a natural kind of biological, going to a higher physical state, or is it more of a kind of state of the mind, spiritual, kind of almost new age?
Well, in terms of a simple definition, transhumanism, they say that, you know, we have gotten where we are by evolution and that we will continue to evolve. We won't always stay the same that we are. But at this point, we are intelligent enough, we've got the technologies, then we should take control of our evolution and then lead it to where we think it should go. And some of these people are radical enough to think that eventually we can get rid of the human body and then we can upload our consciousness into computers or some sort of a universal sort of mind. So both, yeah. If you want an interesting, if you need a topic sometime for an English assignment, punch in transhumanism and then you've got you've got some very interesting folks there. Nick Bostrom is at Oxford. Nick Bostrom is sort of the kingpin in all of this. He used to be at Princeton, I believe, or no, maybe it was Yale. But he is developing a complete philosophical system for all of this. And where we are now is just a transitional point. That's where the trans in it comes from.
It's a movement.
It is a movement, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you'll find overlap. There are segments of transhumanism that Peter Singer will plug right into. The transhumanists are very, very shrewd and very political. They understand what it means to have a different idea in the culture, and they also understand how you get those ideas broadcast and how to become influential. So they have all these conferences, they write books, and you'll have people writing. Arthur Kaplan, who heads up the bioethics program at the University of Pennsylvania, probably the most influential bioethicist in this country at the academic level. Arthur Kaplan wrote a chapter in one of their books, or maybe multiple books. He speaks at their conferences. Gregory Stock, the biophysicist at UCLA, Redesigning Humans is his book. He speaks at their conferences. And Lee Silver at Princeton, a molecular biologist, he speaks at their conferences, and vice versa. So there's a lot of overlap with the transhumanist. And you'll find Lee Silver, I didn't bring that essay, but he has a book about remaking Eden. And his whole thing is that, and this goes back to the sociology of all of this, is that he sees the reproductive technologies in conjunction with genetics, and he calls it reprogenetics. He sees that as an instrument of changing our species. Now, he probably would not call himself a transhumanist, because he's in research, you know, and has a prominent position as a molecular biologist at Princeton. But he'd never probably not call himself a transhumanist, but he sees using these things to change. And in this book, he has a chapter, and there's an essay on the internet about changing the nature of the human family. And then one example would be the lesbian couple in Too Much to Carry. But the transhumanists are working very hard at developing philosophically and programmatically their ideas and influence. You know, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, those guys would have only been able to do what? They would write science fiction. Now they can get a PhD in philosophy or something like that. They can get prestigious chairs, and then they can actually do philosophy that influences the science that furthers their agenda. I didn't answer your question completely. Anything you'd like to add? These are just radically different worldviews, yeah. And Peter Singer is a materialist, and that's.
I think is you're right that one of the key things is that he doesn't have a theistic outlook, and because of that, his understanding of the human condition is going to be limited to this life and this life only. And I think for many people like Singer, and for some of the others, even at the ordinary level, who are seeking to remedy what they implicitly understand as the human condition, for many of those people, the human condition is really one in which suffering is the worst evil. And so anything and everything that we can do to make people's lives, at least on the surface, happy, right? Where what happy means is pain-free, as much ease as we can have, both psychological and physical, that's really what's the chief enemy of the human condition. And I think, when I think about, from the Christian perspective, of course, suffering is indeed an evil, but it's not the greatest evil, right? The greatest evil that's part of the human condition is separation from God, right? It's death, eternal death, eternal separation from God. And so while suffering is something that we don't want or we don't seek, we understand that it's something we can accept because it's not the worst evil in the world.
Yeah, we can accept it, we can learn from it, we can be redemptive. Someone alluded to that earlier.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
In all of this, I'm trying to grasp everything, but I know that suffering, you know, as far as in life, this is basically a part of it. But with all of this reconstructing the person and trying to create the perfect world, perfect person, perfect life, there's still the option of free will. If a person still has free will and they decide, well, you know, I'm going to kill this person, or I'm going to cross this line and do this, or I'm going to do that, that's still not, I mean, it seems like they can't stop. They're, how are they going to be able to stop that if a person has that free will? Because even with Peter Singer, he has free will, he makes his choices. And with everyone else, they have that, and they make their own choices of which way they're going to go in life. So how are they going to be able to do that? I don't see how they'll be able, even though they want to genetically control everything or whatever, how are they going to be able to control that once you get to that point in life where you say, I am going to do this or move this way or make this decision in my life?
I'm not sure I understand your question. You have a, is that a comment or a question? I'm not
it's
sure.
Probably a mixture.
Oh, okay.
I'm
okay.
Sorry. But I was just, but because of all of that, I'm like, I look at it as God has a plan. And he already knows what's going to happen. At least, you know, I'm not probably as well-versed in the Bible as everybody else, but that's what I've always been taught, was that, you know, God is the head of my life. God has a plan. He knows what's going to happen. You know, things, let it be. You know, they'll work. He'll work it out.
And in fact, I think probably in the culture, there's hardly any way to put real checks on this. I think we're far enough along in terms of the mindset of the culture and the technology, and then the combination of the two. It's going to be hard to restrict and control these things. So part of what we have to do, what we have to figure out as Christians, is how we, individually and as a church, how we react to them and how we deal with them within the church. And I think pastors have a responsibility to teach their people that there are some limits, there are some things that we have to suffer, and that is just part of our commitment to a Christian view, a high view of what it means to be human, to the image of God and man. And so we suffer in order to, I mean, we could relieve some suffering and then undermine the view of humanity. We can undo that. So I think it's a responsibility of the church to say that, yeah, we have to resist this within the church, and then we got to figure out how to do that in the broader culture.
In all of that, are there, you know, when say Peter Singer is on some type of board or something, and people like him, are there any Christian people that just, they're Christians, but they're on those boards to say, hey, this is that we know of, that have stood up, that you can say, you know, you pull this person up and they've stood up and said this, and you can kind of follow them, like, you know, looking at what Singer has written and some of the other authors that we've looked at.
Yeah,
but I just didn't remember any of the main Christian ones.
Yeah, in bioethics, it is really a secular discipline. But within bioethics, there are a few folks. Edmund Pellegrino at Georgetown is one. Gilbert Mylander at Valparaiso University. Peter Lawler at Berry College. The outgoing President's Council of Bioethics, a number of Christians, outstanding Christian thinkers, philosophers, ethicists, were on that. Peter Lawler, for example, is a political scientist, but he spent 5, 6, 7 years working on bioethics. So in that arena, there are some people who are Christian, who bring their Christian worldview. And like Leon Cass, who's very much in sync with us, but he grew up in a non-believing family, but he comes from he's Jewish, and so he's worked back toward his Jewish tradition. So he brings a lot of that, as well as some of his humanistic thinking, to bear. And it was his guidance that provided a slot for Peter Lawler, Gilbert Mylander, and those kind of folks to serve on the President's Council. But there are bioethics, there are ethics committees in all hospitals, and that's a great opportunity for Christians to serve. I tried to get involved with the one in our community. and they would not have anything to do with me, because I think I was too obvious, and I didn't want to be there to try to dictate. I just wanted to be there partly to learn and partly to be a part of the process, to be salt and light. So there are opportunities even at the community level to do these sorts of things, and a lot of hospitals would be happy to have a capable layperson who is interested in these issues to get involved, either as an observer or maybe even serve on an ethics committee, because they typically will have a community representative or two. So let's move on to this other talk, and we will get back to this very issue of what the worldviews look like. Now, this talk that I just did, I wanted to lay out some issues, four categories of issues, and then raise the question of the human condition. In this talk, I'm going to get more specific, more general. With Peter Singer, we have preference utilitarianism. We have a very materialistic view of the world. Singer is a materialist. He's an atheist. But he is only one little segment in a larger therapeutic culture that we live in. For me, as I work with these issues, and again, I've already said this, it's very important not to just sit down and clinically analyze the particular thing, because when you push it down to a certain level, you can just be very pragmatic. Will this work? Will this help the woman get pregnant? Not asking about the moral status of embryos that we might have to freeze or whatever. So it's important to get the big picture. And for me, I've tried to, in my own limited way and with a limited amount of time, try to get a broad picture of the culture. Where is the culture at? Where is the culture going? What is the big trends in the culture that influence the decisions that we make? So in this talk, I'll get to that. But first, I want to give you some background. I've called this talk Biotechnology and the Rise of Anti-Culture. Biotechnology and the Rise of Anti-Culture Beyond Good, God, and Man. I like that title. See if I can handle it. Now, what I did on this is a little different presentation. Before, I spoke from an outline. This will be more like reading a paper. Yes, ma'am. Oh, the title again, Biotechnology and the Rise of Anti-Culture, Beyond Good, God, and Man. I had originally done the work on this, started working on it and writing it as a paper, hoping to get it published. Then for this talk, I went back, rewrote some, and then did some editing work. And so I'll be reading this more as reading a paper. As we go along, even so, you know, raise a hand, ask a question. There is a segment in here where I will talk about issues, and this is to give examples more of specific issues that relate to the concept of enhancement, which I will define for you. Biotechnology and the Rise of Anti-Culture, Beyond Good, God, and Man. Baseball. Whoever wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball. This famous observation was made in 1954 by the cultural historian Jacques Barzan. He described baseball in poetic terms as the game that provided a window into the soul of the nation by reflecting such American virtues as individual initiative, courage, and physical prowess. But by the year 2000, Americans had become obsessed with another pastime, freeing themselves from the anxieties of everyday life. This obsession had begun in the 1950s with the development of the tranquilizer Miltown, which became the most popular prescription drug in America within 2 years of its introduction. Valium, another tranquilizer, superseded Miltown in the 1960s, and by the 1990s, antidepressants had become the most profitable drug class of all. Today, they are the most commonly prescribed drug in the country, with 19 million adult users. 19 million adult users, it doesn't count the children, the teenagers. With 19 million adult users nationwide, sales of antidepressants reached $10 billion in 2005, 50 years after the introduction of Miltown. How could it be that a nation famed for its dedication to the pursuit of happiness should also be such a fertile market for antidepressant medication? Now, that is a question that is raised by Carl Elliott in one of the articles that I ask you to read. It's called American Bioscience Meets the American Dream. It's very insightful. And a couple of these quotes in here I've picked up from that article, although I have and have read the book better than well. So this is one of the questions that Carl Elliott asked. He also wonders how it is that in a country whose citizens are known the world over for their outgoing self-confidence should emerge as the leading consumer of drugs for social anxiety. After a brief survey of the developments in the pharmaceutical industry over the past 50 years, which is in the article here, Bioscience Meets the American Dream, Elliott concludes that rather than looking to baseball, if you want to understand America, you must first understand Prozac. First of all, you must understand Prozac. Prozac, in Elliott's statement, is symbolic of a much broader range of biotechnologies that have developed since the 1950s. These technologies are often referred to as enhancement or cosmetic or lifestyle technologies. They aim not at healing, that is, making people healthy and whole, but rather at making people better than well. The goal of enhancement is the realization of some personal ambition, some desire, some ideal that goes beyond health and normal functioning. Let's look at some examples to clarify what we mean by biotech enhancement. Number one, the first on the list, eliminating the consequences of aging. You may not know this, but a lot of the transhumanist movement is to get rid of aging, to live. There is an immortality project within the transhumanist movement. And they feel that some of those folks will predict that even people living today, there will be people who will live to 150. You know, the normal lifespan is 120 or 23 or something like that. They predict that there are people alive now who will live to be 150. And they consider aging as a disease. Aging is a disease to be cured. So eliminating the consequences of aging is number one. So when we normally talk about the problems of aging, we're usually thinking about cosmetic procedures, nose jobs Botox injections to remove wrinkles. You're familiar with Botox? Okay. But the new reproductive technologies have provided other ways to eliminate the consequences of aging. In 2005, a 66-year-old woman, postmenopausal, of course, a 66-year-old woman gave birth to a baby after undergoing fertility treatments for 9 years. This retired university professor used eggs from a known donor and sperm from an anonymous donor. Donor, of course, being a euphemism for buying gametes. And that's technically what happens. The issues here are numerous. What does it mean to be a parent? To bring a child into the world without the benefit of a father? What does it mean to be a family? To rear children? To give them a good start in life? What does it mean to have a 14-year-old when you're 80? Can you think of that? And no husband. I follow this lady. She is really having a struggle. And what's happened, nobody is really stepping up. And the doctor who did the procedure, he has had to get involved now to help care for this little girl. And this is happening more and more often when you hear of the movie starlet who's in her 40s and she's having twins. It's usually in vitro, and in many cases, there are other procedures going on to help her, and especially in the 50s. We have women now. You hear read these articles all the time. Women in the 50s doing these procedures. And so they have to go through all these hormone treatments in order to prepare their body so that they can accept a pregnancy. They can get pregnant and carry the pregnancy. The second thing that I want to mention here is performance enhancement. We've touched on this just a little bit in the other talk and the questions, but the issue of enhancement in sports has been hotly debated, and then certainly in the academic arena. And this raises a lot of questions. What is academic achievement? What is academic excellence and so forth? Third, social problems as a disease. Is shyness a disease? If you go to the Paxil website, this is a bit of what you will read. Quote, people with social anxiety disorder have an overwhelming and persistent fear of social situations, such as going to a party, dancing, or eating in public. Other people have a strong fear of situations in which they have to be in front of people, such as talking in front of a group. They may also worry and so on and so on. So what you have here is a drug being used, and essentially shyness has been medicalized. And if you read the article by Carl Elliott, he gives the example what's the guy's name? Williams, a running back who became an advocate for Paxil.
Ricky
Williams, So the message continues with a long list of some symptoms that a person may have, and it concludes with the promise that there is a way to overcome social anxiety disorder. That is, go to your doctor. So what they're doing by this advertisement is driving Paxil. It's a marketing technique. Is shyness a disease? That's a question that we have to sort through. Will the absence of struggle, the struggle to learn to overcome social problems, make for better people? Is a pill that reduces inhibitions the best solution? Will a society be better without shy people? We've already talked about designer children. Then another enhancement that we could talk about is human growth hormone. That comes up in the athletic arena, but also for boys who have a problem growing. They don't grow as fast as everybody, so they're on the low end of the spectrum, or maybe just a little bit below. Instead of waiting for them to catch up, parents go to doctors, and doctors will tell you they get browbeaten by these parents wanting human growth hormone to help their little boys catch up. So in 2003, the FDA approved prescription for the growth, the artificial growth hormone Humatrope for children who were short but otherwise healthy. So prior to the policy revision, doctors had to justify the prescription based on hormonal deficiency or some other health problem. This is a change in policy that has been described as cosmetic endocrinology, since the benefits relate primarily to self-esteem. Again, is shortness a disease? How important is it to minimize problems in the lives of our children? Can we make it too easy for our kids? I'll mention one other example here before we get on to looking and analyzing enhancement, and that is the pill for the owies. Yes, ma'am.
My nephew was 3 pounds, 19 ounces, little her, and I guess when he was 3, 4, something like that, it was determined that he didn't have a deficiency hormone.
Yes, ma'am.
He would have been around 4 feet. Yeah. And my sister and her husband gave the injection 3 times a week till he reached puberty in his regular size.
Right.
As we're saying, if he'd been 4 feet or under, then that would have been. But anyway, that is a classic.
Yeah. Now the thing is, and I'm glad you bring that up, because we have to make some real careful distinctions here, because when this was developed, it was for people like that who really needed a treatment. But now we have people who are worried that their kid's going to be short, people will pick on him or whatever, you know. And so they go to the doctor to say, you need to be a little taller. And of course, you know, research indicates that tall people are more successful for whatever reason. And so parents think about that. So getting them at the right kindergarten, getting the straight teeth, the right schools all the way up. And this is just another way of making sure that we can compete in life. So there are, for a lot of these things, there are spectrum disorders, just like, you know, Ritalin. There are people who really need Ritalin. On one end of the spectrum, on the other end, there are people who purely use it for, you know, some sort of enhancement in a particular situation. So. Yes, sir?
Going back a few minutes to the comment you had made earlier about some of the transhumanist interviews, that maybe even people today, there are some people alive today who may live to see 150 years. And definitely not today, soon. I assume that is with not only like many of the different techniques that we've talked about tonight, but like also maybe some ones we haven't talked about. But I guess the one I'm thinking of that we've talked about is obviously like maybe surgeries to get some type of implantations of mechanical type things going, but also with drugs, I'm assuming.
Or the new field of regenerative medicine. Because they're looking at, in the lab, growing replacement body parts.
So, but in the long term, I mean, obviously it comes back to the question of what it means to be human, but
I guess for the transhumanists, I mean, their view is ultimately one in which that they feel as though where we are as humans now is just not the best place, and we're going to continue to grow to a better place,
right?
Whatever that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the typical view of a transhumanist concerning the human experience as in how we know it now, as far as physically?
Well, they just feel like Mother Nature, if you read the article by Max Moore, you know, Mother Nature, his letter to Mother Nature, well, you know, we thank you for all the good things that you've done, but you really did a bad job. You quit working on us 100,000 years ago, Max Moore says. And so he says, now, and even in gratitude for what Mother Nature, and essentially he's talking about the evolutionary process, in gratitude for what you've done, we want to say thanks, but you haven't quite got it done. Now we're going to take over and do it ourselves. And so that letter is a bit of a manifesto on where we're going to take ourselves. So we have the ability, we have the technology, we have the vision to enhance ourselves and move beyond. So regenerative medicine is really a big part of this. And regenerative medicine includes not only replacement organs, but also different sorts of enhancements. Some of these, we'll look at brain implants to enhance our memory, drugs to enhance our memory. We're already working on drugs that will help us to not just remember, but also drugs that will selectively help us forget traumatic decisions. The transhumanists, the bottom line with a number of folks in the mainline bioethics, they're in agreement. They just don't get there the same way. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Regenerative medicine. Punch that into Google, and you'll find tons of suggestions on how this can be done. You know, we're looking at an artificial womb. And Cornell, the lady, the doctor at Cornell, says, who works on artificial womb, she says we're 5 years away, 10 years at most, in having an artificial womb in which we can gestate. And, of course, the logic there is that if a baby is born prematurely or some accident happens, and we could put the baby in the artificial womb and carry it on. But then, of course, that would be used to gestate, you know, embryos from the beginning, if possible. Now, some of you guys were talking outside. The technologies here, there's nothing in the culture, and that's what we want to get to here. There's nothing in the culture to put the brakes on this stuff. It's money and time. Let's move on. I trust that these examples help clarify what we mean by biotech enhancement. This drive to realize some personal ambition, some desire, some ideal beyond health and normal functioning. There is much about enhancement that I won't be able to touch on, of course, but I do want to especially focus on the cultural revolution that these advances that advances this new conception of what it means to be human. But I'd like to mention two things before we move on. First, enhancement is not just simply about looking better, feeling better, or performing better. It is not always that superficial. It is about much more, it is often much more subtle and significant. These technologies are used to shape or uncover a new sense of personal identity. I'll mention a couple examples, and here I will pick up and talk about Ricky Williams, the obsessive bodybuilder who couldn't wait for results of exercise and special diet. He said, I, for one, couldn't wait 3 or 4 or 5 years to become myself. He continues, I was so uncomfortable not being me that I had to have steroids now. And then the NFL running back, Ricky Williams. He began taking therapy and started taking the antidepressant Paxil. And he said, soon I was able to start acting like the real Ricky Williams. So we're talking about personal identity.
Is this not the same Ricky Williams that did all the marijuana
in Miami,
or is this a different Ricky Williams?
I don't know if it is. I don't follow football.
That's what I was sitting here because I'm like, him?
This one is notorious for his marijuana use over the years and has gotten himself into.
Is he a running back?
Running back.
He's probably the same guy. Yeah.
More problems than a little.
Oh, okay. So this quote that I just read you is taken from a statement that Williams made as a paid spokesman for GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of Paxil. which was the first antidepressant to receive FDA approval for use for social anxiety disorder. In both cases, the goal of enhancement was establishing an identity, a goal that goes beyond health and normal functioning. And the second thing I want to mention about enhancement is that not all enhancements raise ethical issues. Few people would argue that it is wrong to use a pig heart valve to repair a human heart, except, of course, probably the animal rights folks. Few people would argue that it is wrong to use contact lenses or laser surgery to improve vision. Needless to say, these things are not always so simple. The line is often blurry between restoring health and doing enhancement, especially when it comes to drugs like Ritalin, dealing with a spectrum disorder like ADHD. The danger is that these distinctions can get lost. And if you're interested in more information, there is a book online. It's called Beyond Therapy. And if you go to bioethics.gov, this is put together by the President's Council on Bioethics about probably 3-4 years ago. Beyond Therapy, and there's a very interesting, a very worthwhile discussion of enhancement. Some of the limits and the limitations of using the term in itself. Now, how do we make sense of the biotech revolution? This cultural revolution is best described and explained, I think, by the sociologist Philip Reeve, author of the book Triumph of the Therapeutic. Philip Reeve is a sociologist who died in 2006. Now, he doesn't talk specifically about bioethics, biotechnology, but he talks about the cultural revolution that has occurred, the changing view of what it means to be human. He talks about what that is in the culture, and that's why he is valuable. Reeve argues that the old culture, which was built on the monotheistic religions of Judaism and Christianity, has passed away and that it has not been replaced, strictly speaking, by a new culture. Rather, he says, we live in a time of anti-culture, a time when social arrangements are organized according to a therapeutic ethos. We'll get into defining that. It is this therapeutic ethos that explains much of the cultural context of the development and the use of the new enhancement technologies. In a complex way, and this is important to note, the development of these technologies both reflect and drive the cultural revolution that is underway. So this therapeutic ethos, this is the big picture. Peter Singer's preference utilitarianism is just one of the legs underneath. This therapeutic ethos, which was developed in the modern, postmodern era, offers a moral stance that is radically different from that in the previous culture, which was based on Judaism and Christianity, and mixed, of course, with some of the higher cultures of Rome and Greece. It offers nothing less than a radically new way of being human. So let's look at 5 or 6 different characteristics of this therapeutic ethos. First is the emancipated self or the autonomous self. The emancipated self or the autonomous self. This is the idea that the individual should be free of any external moral authority. In the earlier pagan and monotheistic religions, cultures, individuals looked outside themselves for moral direction, to natural law, to divine revelation, to the religious community, or to some sort of transcendence, or even in some cases to a transcendent being. But the therapeutic ethos represents a new way and a new and a very different moral order. The individual self is now central. The self is the final arbiter of moral authority. There is no truth outside the individual that sets boundaries and directs his moral decisions. James Nolan, in his book, The Therapeutic State, says it this way: where once the self was to be surrendered, denied, sacrificed, and died to, now the self is to be esteemed, actualized, affirmed, and unfettered. This is the autonomous self. The second characteristic, we have the autonomous or the emancipated self. The second characteristic is the ethic of emotivism. We're looking at the characteristics of the therapeutic ethos. According to this ethic, the ethic of emotivism, personal feelings become arbiters of right and wrong. Emotivism, Alistair McIntyre says, emotivism is the doctrine that all emotive judgments, and more specifically, all moral judgments, are nothing but expressions of preference, expressions of attitude or feeling, insofar as they are moral or evaluative in character. Alistair McIntyre points out also that according to this ethic, saying that something is good is the same as saying, I approve of this, or hooray for that. It is all a matter of personal preference. For the ethic of emotivism, the central moral question relates to individual fulfillment. Sounding like Peter Singer, sort of, right? Relates to personal fulfillment. Is the individual happy and fulfilled? The focus is on individual satisfaction rather than on whether the individual conforms to some system of moral demands outside himself. The drive is to be happy rather than good. There is no objective good out there since truth resides in the preferences of the individual. The third characteristic of the therapeutic ethos is that there is a new cultural elite that has taken over in the society. The therapeutic ethos has produced a group of societal leaders, not always out front and obvious, but always present and influential. In the past, religious leaders gave considerable direction to the moral order of the culture. Religious leaders in the past gave direction. Philip Reif points out that the professionally religious custodians of the old moral demands are no longer authoritative. And along the same lines, Christopher Lash, the historian, points out that in the past, folks looked to their parents, priests, lawgivers, and so forth for direction. Now we look to the medical profession and the psychiatric, psychiatrist for moral authority, for direction. And we see this in churches. I see this in my church. You know, even marital problems get referred to a psychologist, or one person winds up going to a psychiatrist. In some cases, I'm sure that's needed. But many pastors default, instead of doing pastoral counseling, they turn to a professional outside. The modern individual turns to therapists, not priests, according to Alistair McIntyre in After Virtue, in the hopes of achieving the modern equivalent of salvation. The modern equivalent of salvation being what? Mental health. That's the way he defines it. The fourth characteristic of the therapeutic ethos is the institutionalization of the therapeutic ethos. And this is very interesting and very significant. The therapeutic ethos is spread from the helping professions throughout the culture as a way of aiding people in making sense of their world. In the educational arena, business management, organizational development, politics, media, advertising, and so forth. All of this has been extensively chronicled by people like James Nolan in The Therapeutic State, James Hunter in The Death of Character, and Jonathan Ember in The Therapeutic Culture. Before moving on, let me just point out one place where the therapeutic ethos has penetrated very much to the core of our legal system. Are any of you familiar with the Supreme Court case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey? This is starting to be a very prominent precedent in a lot of legal debates and court cases. In 1992, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the right of abortion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and in the major opinion, the justices wrote, this is a quote, At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of life. End of quote. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of life. Now there is a definition of the human condition, right? And one that will have weight in the culture that we will have to all live with in various ways. So it's penetrated to the very core of our legal system. It's really a superb summary of the therapeutic ethos. It's really what it is. It couldn't be said any more succinctly. Yes, ma'am.
Heal their landfill.
There's a real history to the background for why we're not culturally involved.
But it's not hopeless. It seems hopeless hearing you talk. It seems hopeless, like that the culture has gone so far off the deep end that there's no way Christians are just going to get buried and forgotten. But that's saying that God is not all powerful. So he can rise us up again.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we can do anything in terms of big picture. Yeah. Justin and I were talking about that over dinner. You know, where am I? What is my segment? And starting the Humanitas Project, I said, this is something that is really, really important. And nobody is addressing it at the lay level. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity, a few places like that, the work is being done by Christians. So we look at the arena that we have influence in and do what we can there. So one of the things that I do is when I have a chance to speak to students, I challenge them to go into bioethics, to go into law, to ask how can we be salt and light in the culture. It's very easy to sit back and say, wow, we could be overwhelmed. And I think probably many Christians did that like 100 years ago when the fundamentalists were retreating from the culture, retreating from the institution. There's a tremendous amount of anti-intellectualism there. If we just get our Bible right, personal piety, live right, those kind of things in our private realm, then we leave the rest up to God or fate or whatever. So there's a withdrawal from the culture. But a lot of people, I think, and they'll say, well, you know, these seculars, they're taking over. This used to be our country. You know, we want to take it back. Well, part of the reason that things are where they are is that Christians abandon the life of the mind, thinking about these sorts of issues, raising these sorts of questions, and trying to work out a theology of culture. And people as far back as T.S. Eliot in the 1940s, in his essays on Christianity and culture, he points out that, you know, there may not be big scheme things that we can do, but there are small things that we can do. And one thing is, obviously, it's not just to say, we're overwhelmed and kind of hunker down. Yes, sir?
At the base of this, are we substituting God's work for human work for God's work? Jeremiah 29 says, for I know the plans I have for you. This is the Lord talking. Declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. You will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you.
And he's speaking to Israel, right?
Yes.
I think the challenge that we have in the culture is that very challenge. To look to God, certainly for his supernatural intervention, but also under God with his grace and his power to say, what would you have for me to do? Esther, you know, where do we stand in the culture? That's the challenge. Yes, sir?
What we have here is a kind of a trend in the early primitive culture. All of your morality and ethics were defined by the tribe. And God, it's interesting that God called Abraham, leave your home, your tribe, your people, and go to. So he called him out so that Abraham, when he could stand in the presence of God as an autonomous individual. And the major players in the Old Testament are all called out of their tribe. You know, Daniel and so many of the other ones, so they could stand. And then God wants us to be in an autonomous state. In what you described, the modern Peter Singers and these people, now we have gone beyond that, beyond God, so that we have these people, we in our modern culture, says that we are God. I am God.
Right, yeah. And but we're not called to be autonomous from God. We're called to be stewards, to be servants of him. We're to be autonomous from the culture. We're not to follow along in the culture.
Yeah, now, in Charles Murray's book, Human Accomplishment, he started out to find out, he's a statistician, and then he started out to find where human accomplishment occurs. And he found out, well, it's in North America and Northern Europe. Why is that? And he said, well, it's Protestant culture. And then he said, why is that? And so he went further, keep working, and he said, because the Protestant stands in a direct relationship to God. And he's creative because of that. And then he came on down to the fact that it's a personal relationship with God that makes people creative, and that's where the major part of the creativity in the world is, in that zone that's influenced. And then he had a footnote there. He said, now, I'm not a Christian. I'm actually married to a Buddhist, a Thai Buddhist, and so my leaning is that way. So he was not trying to justify Christianity, but he came to that conclusion of this autonomy that we... That is the, but what you're describing is these people have taken this autonomy beyond the realm of where it should be, and now it's been destructive autonomy.
It's become very destructive. Yeah, in fact, it is the ethos of our culture. Let's pick up and finish off, and then we'll take some time to come back and talk. The institutionalization of the therapeutic ethos is number four. Number five is the pathologizing of human behavior. Another aspect of therapeutic culture is the tendency to interpret an increasingly wide range of human behaviors in terms of disease or illness that need healing. The common term for this is medicalization. On one hand, people categorize life's normal ups and downs as medical problems and look for medical solutions. On the other, the medical profession and the pharmaceutical industry do the same thing by encouraging essentially healthy people to seek unnecessary medical products and services. And of course, the medical professionals have other motives too. You know, they encourage people to have procedures that they really don't need in order to protect themselves from lawsuits. So they're in a double bind on some of these things. So you can see why they were making some of these decisions. The historian Christopher Lash pointed out that sickness and health replace guilt, sin, and atonement as the dominant concerns guiding those who struggle to make sense of the buried life of the mind. So I think there we're starting to get really to some of the things that we talked about earlier. Sickness and health become the obsessions of our culture. We don't want to be sick, we want to be healthy. This is a part of the therapeutic mindset. Medicalization is to be expected in a therapeutic society. Since a therapeutic ethos provides the dominant and the only moral language in our society, feelings, self-fulfillment, self-esteem, actualization, and authenticity, those are the terms, the therapeutic ethos contributes to the expansion of what is considered illness and disease. It is the only moral language that is available for discussing and resolving problems such as alcoholism, gambling, shyness, anxiety, youthful inability to sit still in school, and so forth. Of course, there are no card-carrying therapeutics. The therapeutic ethos, rather, is a summarizing term for a viewpoint, a disposition, a sentiment, a guiding vision. It operates quite oftenly below the surface at the level of assumptions. It is in the cultural air that we breathe. These things are caught, they're inhaled, they're caught as well as taught. This sort of cultural analysis is not isolated to the work of one or two scholars. It dominates It's prominent in the work of Philip Reeve, James Davison Hunter, Alistair McIntyre, Christopher Lash, Paul Vitz, and so forth. On the conservative end of the spectrum, these are the conservative folks. On the more liberal end of the spectrum, thinking specifically of the bioethics arena, the therapeutic ethos would be viewed favorably by people like Gregory Stock, the biophysicist at UCLA. It'd be viewed favorably by Lee Silver in science and Arthur Kaplan in bioethics. It would include almost all mainstream bioethics, especially those who consider themselves to be progressive bioethicists. Most recently, Christian Smith, and this is interesting, this is jumping out of the field of bioethics just for a second. Most recently, Christian Smith, in a book called Soul Searching, argued that the religion of American teens could best be described as moralistic therapeutic deism. I hope some of you guys are reading this. If you have teenagers, you really need to, or if you work with a youth group, you need to read that book called Soul Searching. He says that their religion can be best described as moralistic therapeutic deism. For American teenagers, quote, God is not demanding. He actually can't be, since his job is to solve our problems and make people feel good. In short, God is something like a combination divine butler and cosmic therapist. And the conservative black church, conservative evangelicals, conservative Catholics, this is a prominent feature even in those groups. So it's not just restricted to the mainline and liberal Catholics where it's most prominent. It's obvious across the board. And the other interesting thing, and I brought this out in a Sunday school class I taught recently, it's reflective of the parents. These kids who have this commitment to this therapeutic ethos reflect the viewpoint of their parents. So they're not like my generation. They're not rebels. You know, the world is not different for the young people and the old people. And I think that presents a challenge to the church right there in terms of thinking about discipleship, youth group, and those sorts of things. Philip Reeve defines culture as world creation. He says that world creation occurs by means of a transliteration of a sacred order into a social order. Can you listen to this? A transliteration of a sacred order into a social order. Culture, then, is a set of moral demands that tells us about sacred order and how we fit into that order. Reeve's concept of moral authority is explained by three terms. He uses interdicts. He says interdicts are commands or moral obligations. Transgressions are violations of the moral demands, and remissions indicate that which is forbidden but which is forgivable as exceptions to the rule. In essence, it is a system of do's, don'ts, and forgivens. Sounds sort of like something we're familiar with, right? The interdicts, the prohibitions that establish moral boundaries, are not simply rules, norms, mores, or values, but are truths that are expected to be binding on individual lives. They are grounded in the sacred and are institutionalized in a social organization as well as absorbed into the individual's consciousness. Reeve points out that all cultures up until our own have been based on some ultimate authority, an authority outside and above the culture, be it grounded in reason, revelation, or both, or some other source of transcendence. However, contemporary society, often called therapeutic culture, doesn't assume a world beyond the visible, a transcendence which presents some final authority. For this reason, the cultural historian Christopher Last says that it makes sense to describe the United States today as a culturalist society. It is a society in which nothing is sacred and therefore nothing is forbidden. Philip Reeve would agree, of course, with this assessment, and he uses the term for this anti-culture. And he uses anti-culture to designate a failure to recognize and to translate any sacred order into a social order. Anti-culture is the term he coined to describe the modern, postmodern moment, a moment when cultural mechanisms work to release, but not to restrain. And all of this, of course, is summarized in the 60s mantra, it is forbidden to forbid. It is forbidden to forbid. Reeve goes even further by introducing another coinage, death works. A death work, and here we come back to our buddy Peter Singer, a death work is a deliberate effort by advocates of therapeutic culture to negate whatever is important, vital that is, to the previous culture. The therapeutic ethos opposes all transcendent sources of authority and seeks to undo all transliterations of the sacred of the previous culture. It is at this point that we have the culture wars as rival visions come into conflict, one positing a sacred moral order and the other proposing a world in which there is no truth and no sacred order. That's the flashpoint. In sum, Philip Reeve's theory of culture offers tremendous insight into the history and the workings of culture. Alas, though, he leaves us with this stark, chilling assessment of our culture, of our current cultural moment. And this gets back to you. Hang on to your chair. So he leaves us with this stark, chilling assessment. He says, where nothing is sacred, there is nothing. Where nothing is sacred, there is nothing. That pretty much describes our cultural moment. It describes the challenge that's in front of us. Reef, for all of his insights, is ultimately nihilistic. He sees no way to go forward, not even through religion. In fact, his assessment is that even the Orthodox are role play. The Orthodox, he believed, let me back up. The Orthodox believe, he argues, because they think it's good for them, not because of anything inherent in the belief. Everything in therapeutic culture, including religion, is used to facilitate the realization of the therapeutic ideal, which is centered on realizing the desires of the individual self for health and happiness. Now, when we think about Christian discipleship, that assessment right there should cause us to wake up and say, are we being conformed to the world, or are we being renewed, transformed by the renewing of our mind? This is the crux of what I'm concerned about with the Humanitas Project, and what we all should be concerned about living in this culture as Christians. Are we conforming? Are we being rather transformed by the renewing of our minds? Going back especially to Christian Smith's analysis. Everything in a therapeutic culture, including religion, is used to facilitate the realization of the therapeutic ideal, which is centered on realizing the desires of the individual self for health and happiness. I would warn, though, against reacting to Reef's assessment of Orthodox religion. Even though he wrote as an unbelieving Jew, he had great sympathy for religion in general and for Christianity in particular. Sometimes I wonder, was this guy really a secret Christian? When you read his stuff, is the most difficult stuff I've ever read, but it's the most insightful. I've been digging around in this stuff for a long time. I'm always trying to find people who can help me understand Reef. But he's very sympathetic to Christianity, and he's definitely not the religion basher that you might expect from the field of sociology. Before concluding, there are a couple of caveats. Let's remember and celebrate the healthcare achievements of modern science, which has done some remarkable things to maintain and restore physical, mental, and emotional health. Not all biotech is problematic. Much of it is absolutely wonderful. Who would wish for a world without antibiotics, without kidney dialysis, the polio vaccine, contact lens, pacemakers, etc.? So let's be careful that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. The second caveat, and this is on the other hand, a contrast, we have good reasons, ample evidence, that many of the biotechnologies will produce enormous mischief in a society that is committed to a therapeutic ethos. And in fact, they already have. And here I reword that question about the human condition a bit differently. I say, what does biotechnology tell us about the postmodern soul? What does it tell us about the postmodern soul? First, that it's self-oriented, that it's an autonomous rebel against transcendent order of any sort. Second, the uses and goals of biotechnology tells us that a major cultural revolution has already occurred. In many cases, the biotechnologies are being used to enact the vision of the therapeutic ethos. Nothing demonstrates this more clearly than the genetic screening used to select children to be born. Children to fit a preconceived design, children who are made, not begotten. These reproductive and genetic technologies, along with many of the other biotechnologies, represent a death work against the preceding Judeo-Christian culture. It sets out to undo the moral vision of this religious tradition in the family, in medicine, in law, in government, in policy, in public education, and more foundationally, in the conception of what it means to be human. In 30-odd years, what was called the culture of death, beginning with Roe v. Wade in 1973, can now be more clearly seen to be the death of culture. So we've moved from a culture of death to the death of culture. In 1998, Lee Silver, a molecular biologist at Princeton, wrote a book called Remaking Eden: How Genetic Engineering and Cloning Will Transform the American Family. He made this approving statement. He said, "I have no doubt that the growing use of reprogenetics is inevitable. For better or worse, a new age is upon us, an age in which we as humans will gain the ability to change the nature of our species." That, of course, remains to be seen. But we can already see the devastating consequences on numerous vital institutions in our culture. As Philip Reeve said, where nothing is sacred, there is nothing. Thank you.